Chapter 7 Home and Garden. Friends, books, a garden, and perhaps his pen, delightful industry enjoyed at home, and nature in her cultivated trim, dressed to his taste, inviting him abroad. Can he want occupation who has these? William Cowper, The Task. Martha Dandridge Custis, a 26-year-old widow, had more going for her than the young women George Washington had known in his youth. Meeting her when he was 25, George saw Martha as a woman of substance, someone who took him seriously and whom he could take seriously. A short woman with chubby cheeks, Martha was physically unremarkable, but she had a comportment that beguiled her suitor. Perhaps Abigail Adams described Martha's demeanor best. Her manners are modest and unassuming, dignified and feminine, not a tincture of hauteur about her. That Martha Custis was quite possibly Virginia's wealthiest widow under 30 did not diminish her appeal. George courted her through the spring of 1758 when he returned to military service. Not until this year was the thorny issue of military rank among British and colonial officers resolved. Finally, colonial officers would be treated with parity, or so it seemed. Satisfied with the outcome of this controversy, Washington resumed command of the Virginia Regiment, serving under General John Forbes, along with 7,000 British regulars. A veteran of the War of the Austrian Succession, Forbes faced a new challenge once assigned the arduous task of capturing Fort Duquesne. Determined to avoid Braddock's errors, he approached his assignment methodically. General Forbes tolerated Washington's colonial troops, but had little respect for them. An extreme bad collection of broken innkeepers, horse jockeys, and Indian traders, he called them, a gathering from the scum of the worst people. Though a great student of the art of war, Forbes was not overly pedantic. Unlike Braddock, he recognized the importance of adapting his military strategy and techniques to suit local conditions. In this country, he admitted, we must comply and learn the art of war from enemy Indians or anything else who have seen the country and war carried on in it. Forbes and Washington clashed when it came to choosing a route to Fort Duquesne. Whereas Washington felt they should follow Braddock's original route, Forbes decided to cut a fresh road through western Pennsylvania. In this instance, Washington seems motivated less by military strategy than by commercial impulses. He knew that whichever road the army cut through the wilderness would affect western expansion. The route Forbes chose would benefit Pennsylvania, not Virginia. Problems with supplies and manpower delayed the trip for months, and Forbes's meticulousness compelled them to proceed at a snail's pace. The French saw the British forces as a juggernaut, albeit a very slow one. By the time British and colonial troops neared Fort Duquesne in late November, the French had burned down the fort and decamped. Washington's last campaign during the Seven Years' War thus ended in anticlimax. Once he returned home from the war, George and Martha were married. On January 6, 1759, presumably at her estate on the Pamunkey River, they tied the knot. That April, George brought to Mount Vernon Martha and her two children, John Park Custis, then 4 years old, and his two-year-old sister, Martha Park Custis, Jackie and Patsy, as they were known in the family. Washington assumed responsibility for his two stepchildren and raised them as his own. In addition, he undertook the burdensome task of administering Jackie's large and complex estate. Settling into the life of a gentleman farmer, Washington worked hard to make Mount Vernon and its outlying plantations a success. His marriage provided the impetus to decorate the house and develop the farm. The month after bringing Martha to Mount Vernon, he placed a sizable order with the London firm of Robert Carey and Company. Carey had been handling the Custis family affairs in London, so Washington saw no reason to discontinue the business relationship. The firm received regular consignments of tobacco from the Custis plantations and supplied whatever manufactured goods the family needed. Washington also let Carey handle much of his own business affairs in London. The first order he placed with the firm included a bedstead decorated with fashionable blue curtains, plus matching window curtains, coverlet, and upholstery. Decorating their bedroom, Washington sought to impress his bride. He wanted to have everything just right, to make the whole furniture of this room uniformly handsome and genteel. This initial order also included several other items to enhance their home and elevate their lifestyle: carpeting, china, glassware, ivory-handled cutlery, and, of course, books. The specific books Washington ordered reflected his desire to broaden his agricultural knowledge. So far, he had been doing what all the big Virginia planters did, dedicating his time and land to tobacco, a demanding crop. It was hard on the soil and hard on the enslaved men and women who tended it. The books Washington ordered after his marriage described alternate crops and alternative approaches to farming. They reflect his desire to diversify his plantations. Washington ordered the newest and most approved treatise of agriculture and a new system of agriculture, or a speedy way to grow rich, as he paraphrased its subtitle. These orders reveal his eagerness to learn the latest agricultural methods, which would help his plantations turn a handsome profit without relying on tobacco. He also requested a gardening handbook and the latest edition of a standard work on farriery. Carey filled the order as best he could. Typically, he subdivided Washington's requests, distributing parts of each order to whichever suppliers who were best qualified to fulfill them. He passed book requests to John Clark, a prominent London bookseller, who obtained three of the works: the second edition of A New System of Agriculture, Batty Langley's New Principles of Gardening, and William Gibson's New Treatise on the Diseases of Horses. This last work was more difficult to procure. Clark, who may have been exaggerating, said only one copy of Gibson's New Treatise could be had in all of London, but he procured it for Washington. All three titles stress the novelty of the works. Though the ones by Langley and Gibson were already several years old, the fact that the word new appeared in their titles made them seem cutting edge. The author of A New System of Agriculture, or A Plain, Easy, and Demonstrative Method of Growing Rich, identifies himself solely as a country gentleman. His true identity has escaped history. Agriculture, strange to say, was a hot topic in the 1750s. Enterprising London publishers could turn a handsome profit issuing books on the subject. Many farming handbooks sprouted not from the soil of the English countryside, but from cracks in the pavement of Grub Street. In retrospect, this so-called country gentleman seems more like a cleverly crafted persona, a rhetorical strategy to validate its author's agricultural ideas. The book does contain some useful advice, but harebrained schemes with little practical value eventually take over the text. Critiquing the author's ideas, a contemporary reviewer quipped, "His three capital schemes are as romantic as ever entered the head of a writer on rural economy." The level-headed Washington, one suspects, found the author's get-rich-quick schemes disappointing. A New System of Agriculture resembled many other contemporary works of husbandry, heavy on theory and light on practice. Whereas this and other contemporary agricultural works reflect increasingly scientific methods, the theorists risked losing touch with the soil. Other agricultural writers promoted their works by emphasizing practical foundations. In Maryland, Charles Carroll of Carrollton a signer of the Declaration of Independence, had an excellent agricultural library. Recommending one agricultural book to Washington, Carroll assured him that its author's knowledge of the subject was based not in theory but in experience. William Fairfax, who knew Langley's work, may have recommended him to Washington. After receiving his copy of Langley's New Principles of Gardening, Washington inscribed the title page. He recorded its cost in the left-hand corner and wrote his name and the year in the right. George Washington, 1760. A major contribution to the history of landscape gardening, Langley's New Principles would profoundly influence the garden Washington designed for Mount Vernon. Langley's gardening vocabulary became his. Washington also accepted Langley's aesthetic, that the curved line was the line of beauty. The preference for curved over straight lines in garden design became so prevalent in the second half of the 18th century that some found it a source of humor. In The Clandestine Marriage, one of the era's leading stage comedies, a social climber named Sterling hopes to marry his daughter to a baronet. Sterling boasts to him that his garden contains no distasteful straight lines, but instead is all taste, zigzag, crinkum crankum, in and out, right and left, to and again, twisting and turning like a worm. New Principles of Gardening, a veritable diatribe against regularity, reads like a manifesto. Langley said that nothing was more shocking than a stiff, regular garden, where, after we've seen one quarter thereof, the very same is repeated in all the remaining parts, so that we are tired, instead of being further entertained with something new as expected. New Principles of Gardening contains many plans for irregular gardens, but Langley's theoretical outlook surpassed his practical designs. While clamoring for irregularity, Langley presented designs that seem comparatively formal and artificial. Though New Principles of Gardening reflects the fashions of the 1720s, Langley's advice often transcends the times. Here's one lasting idea. There is nothing more agreeable in a garden than good shade, and without it a garden is nothing. Here's another. Those great beauties of nature, hills and valleys, were always leveled at very great expenses to complete their regularity, or otherwise I may justly say the total ruin of the garden. Langley's emphasis on keeping the terrain as natural as possible appealed to prosperous Virginians who sought pleasure gardens of their own. Washington found the garden plans attractive yet impractical, being too complex for use at Mount Vernon. He radically simplified Langley's ideas to apply them to his situation. Washington kept the concept that a garden should be a large park surrounding all four sides of a house, and that it should contain a variety of elements. He already had one of Langley's most fundamental requirements for a great garden, a beautiful and extensive view. The expanse of the Potomac provided a magnificent view, the most beautiful in the world, according to one 18th-century visitor. Washington carefully landscaped the slope from the house down to the river to frame the view, not obscure it. Books belonging to the Custis household came to Mount Vernon upon Martha's marriage to George. There's little evidence to indicate which works belonged on Martha's bookshelf, with two notable exceptions. When she had married Daniel Custis in 1749, Martha took possession of a family manuscript dating back to the 17th century. A two-part work, the manuscript consists of A Book of Cookery and A Book of Sweetmeats. Whereas the second part is devoted to sweets, the first is devoted to savory dishes. It contained recipes for stuffed leg of veal, roast leg of mutton, Oxford sausages, capon poached after the Flanders fashion, porridge of old peas, and many kinds of savory pies, chicken pie, pigeon pie, veal and bacon pie, and even humble pie. Humbles, or umbles, are the organ meats of a deer. Martha would continue to use this manuscript recipe book throughout her marriage to George, and ultimately pass it down to her granddaughter. A Book of Cookery serves as a reminder of the ongoing importance of manuscript culture in 18th-century America. Many different English cookbooks were published during the century, but there is no evidence that Martha Washington added any to the library at Mount Vernon. Her manuscript cookbook was so detailed and so thorough that others were unnecessary. Martha also had a manuscript music book that she kept during her first marriage and continued to use throughout her second. It contained the airs of Handel, minuets and gavottes of Jean-Baptiste Lully, a 17th-century French composer, and such popular songs as Lovely Nancy, The Wedding Day, and Oh Dear, What Can the Matter Be, all in Martha's handwriting. Her interest in Handel is part of the times. All connoisseurs of music, John Quincy Adams observed, are extravagantly fond of Handel. Her appreciation for the Baroque stylings of Lully is more unusual, but not unheard of. Regardless, it is fun to imagine George and Martha Washington dancing a gavotte through the halls of Mount Vernon. Books from her first husband that came to Mount Vernon also included one of Gervase Markham's numerous works on farriery, most likely Markham's masterpiece. Wanting something more up-to-date, Washington ordered the latest edition of William Gibson's New Treatise on the Diseases of Horses. The foremost British authority on the care of horses, Gibson wrote several works on farriery, but New Treatise is his masterwork. Washington's eye for horseflesh has been taken as a natural gift, but he understood that books could expand his knowledge. Less than 2 months after Gibson's New Treatise reached Mount Vernon, Washington had the opportunity to put the book to use. An unusual storm brought damaging winds and excessive rain late one Thursday evening in February 1760. By Friday morning, the storm abated enough to let him spend much of the day outdoors erecting a fence around his peach orchard. Friday afternoon, he went to Belvoir to invite Lord Fairfax to dinner. Returning to Mount Vernon that night, Washington discovered that the right foreleg of Jolly, one of his best wagon horses, was, in his words, mashed to pieces. A heavy tree limb had fallen on Jolly during the storm the previous night, badly breaking its leg. Gibson's New Treatise was useless on this occasion. Since Gibson saw a horse's broken leg as a death sentence, he had nothing to say about how to set one. Desperate to save Jolly, Washington reverted to Markham, who supplied more amenable advice. "The old traditions in horse leechcraft affirm that all fractures above the knee are incurable, and so despairing, they cease to make practice. But they are much deceived, for neither the fracture above the knee nor the fracture below the knee is more incurable in a horse than in a man, if the farrier can tell how to keep the horse from struggling or tormenting the member aggrieved." Markham provides detailed instructions, which Washington followed as closely as he could. "First, sling up the horse with a strong double canvas, and then raise it so that its hooves just barely touch the ground. For a broken foreleg, elevate the front of the horse so that it can place its weight on its hind legs. Once the horse is slung, reset the bone and then wrap it in a cloth of unwashed wool newly pulled from a sheep's back, binding it fast to the leg with a smooth linen roller soaked in oil and vinegar. Splint it with 3 broad, smooth, strong splints, binding them fast at each end with a thong, keeping the horse's leg very straight." According to Markham, the horse would have to stay in its sling, and the splints would have to stay on its leg for 40 days. A hard prescription. 2 days later, Washington discovered that Jolly had fallen from its sling, struggled considerably, and re-injured the leg. Sadly, he now had no choice and ordered Jolly to be shot to death. Though neither Gibson nor Markham could help him save Jolly, Washington did not dismiss the written word as a way of learning more about practical methods of caring for his horses. Within the next few years, in fact, he acquired The Complete Horseman, or Perfect Farrier, a work by Jacques Le Bessis de Solecel, a self-taught horseman and veterinarian who taught the art of horsemanship to French nobility. The leading authority on the subject in France, Solecel broke new ground in the diagnosis and treatment of equine diseases. His Complete Horseman gave Washington additional information to supplement Gibson and Markham. Besides telling how to cure sick horses, Solecel discussed the art of riding, describing a horse's natural movements, the rider's proper position, the use of the spur, and the way to execute the movements of dressage. Though Washington's horsemanship continually impressed others, his riding skill was not merely a matter of natural ability. The presence of Solecel in his library indicates that Washington studied how to ride more effectively and more elegantly. Unsure what Washington had meant when he requested the newest and most approved treatise of agriculture, Clark narrowed the possible works that fit the description down to two and sent both, Francis Holmes' Principles of Agriculture and Vegetation and Edward Lyell's two-volume Observations in Husbandry. Washington had not intended either, but once they arrived, he added both to his growing library. According to Dr. Alexander Hunter, Holmes' Principles was a work well deserving the attention of every philosophical farmer. Holmes was one of the earliest experimenters to apply chemistry to agriculture, thus putting agriculture on a sound scientific basis. His rigorous methodology is clear throughout the work. He potted plants in soil treated with different chemicals, measured the results, and compared their efficacy. Washington would develop a reputation for his agricultural experiments at Mount Vernon. They were partly inspired by this book he received accidentally. He would continue studying how chemicals affected plant growth, later acquiring an innovative treatise outlining the connection between agriculture and chemistry. Edward Lyell's Observations in Husbandry, while making no pretense of being a complete guide to its subject, gave readers a huge amount of agricultural information. Despite its haphazard quality, the book contains a vast amount of practical detail and a number of agricultural observations. Lyell deserves credit for collecting traditional wisdom that had circulated orally among British farmers for generations, which new farmers could now put to good use. Before receiving either Holmes' Principles or Lyell's Observations, Washington wrote Carey a follow-up letter clarifying what he meant by the newest and most approved agricultural treatise, one that was done by various hands, but chiefly collected from the papers of Mr. Hale. A few more letters of clarification crossed the Atlantic before Washington received what he wanted, The Complete Body of Husbandry. According to its title page, this work was based on papers assembled by someone named Thomas Hale, about whom nothing else is known. Hale may be a fictional persona invented by the actual compiler, possibly the miscellaneous writer John Hill. The work found other readers in early America. In Maryland, Charles Carroll, not Charles Carroll of Carrollton, but his distant cousin, who is generally known as Charles Carroll Barrister, had a copy at Mount Clare, his home on the outskirts of Baltimore. Carroll's correspondence shows him using the work for reference. On one occasion, he copied from The Complete Body of Husbandry a long list of seeds, beetroot, broccoli, celery, and many other vegetables, which he ordered directly from London. Like Edward Lyell, the compiler of The Complete Body of Husbandry, Hale or Hill or whoever, understood the value of tried and true farming methods. Washington saw similarities between the two authors and shelved their works together at Mount Vernon. The Complete Body of Husbandry reinforces the practice over theory argument. Too often, its author claims, farms have been ruined by inexperienced farmers following the latest methods espoused by inexperienced agricultural authors. Recording traditional methods, on the other hand, was difficult. Old-timers hesitated to share their ideas with bookish compilers. Happily, the author of The Complete Body of Husbandry found several farmers willing to share their practical ideas. Enhancing these old methods with newer approaches, the work supplied valuable advice for young farmers. George Washington belonged to its ideal readership. In June 1764, Washington purchased from the Virginia Gazette office in Williamsburg an agricultural book by his boyhood friend Buckner Stith. The day books of the Gazette office list the title as Treatise on Tobacco. Its real title is unknown because no copies of it survive. Apparently, the work presented a general overview of tobacco culture in Virginia. It is unfortunate that it has been lost. The one surviving letter Stith wrote to Washington shows he had a delightful writing style and a passion for tobacco, its cultivation, and its use. In the letter, he says that smoking three bowls can induce a pleasant inebriation, a heady feeling of nostalgia and excitement. The year Stith published his pamphlet, other writers warned readers about the dangers of tobacco. In Cautions Against the Immoderate Use of Snuff Founded on the Known Qualities of the Tobacco Plant, John Hill advocated total abstinence from tobacco, recommending the British government ban its use altogether. Some readers thought Hill protested too much. Reviewing the pamphlet, Sir Tanfield Leman, a London physician, said Hill was arraigning a fashionable custom with as much acrimony as an antiquated prude would rail against the frailty of the flesh. Seizing upon one of Hill's more frivolous arguments, that snuff could lead to excessive belching, Sir Tanfield wondered, supposing this wicked powder of tobacco should travel from the stomach downward to the intestines and cause certain commotions de orsum, might not the consequential explosions a posteriori give equal, if not greater, offense to delicacy than the unmannerly eructations a superiori? In retrospect, Hill's discussion of tobacco's harmful effects is astonishingly modern. He was the first to identify a relationship between snuff and nasal cancer. There is no evidence that Washington read Hill's cautions, but his decision to shift agricultural production at Mount Vernon from tobacco to other crops, though economically motivated, could have been influenced by health concerns. By 1764, Washington had already started growing wheat as a cash crop. Over the next 5 years, he expanded his wheat production 20-fold. He also began producing other cash crops, hemp, flax, oats, slowly phasing out the cultivation of tobacco at Mount Vernon. Among Washington's surviving papers is a set of notes transcribing or summarizing many passages from Jethro Tull's Horse-Hoeing Husbandry, the agricultural manual that laid the groundwork for the so-called New Husbandry, which departed from traditional methods of agriculture by incorporating the latest technological developments. Washington's notes from Jethro Tull reinforce the shift in agricultural production his farm at Mount Vernon was undergoing. He transcribed Tull's discussions of wheat and hemp at considerable length. Washington took additional notes from Jethro Tull elsewhere. His 1760 diary contains a lengthy paraphrase from Tull regarding the cultivation of alfalfa. His editors have identified the copy Washington used as the 1751 edition of Horse-Hoeing Husbandry, but this title is not listed in his 1764 library catalog, nor does a copy of it survive among his other books. Its absence from the Mount Vernon Library may have something to do with practices of borrowing and loaning books in early America. Did Washington borrow the book from a friend and take notes from it, thus obviating the need for him to purchase a copy for himself? Or did he loan his copy of Horse-Hoeing Husbandry to a friend who never returned it? If the second option is the case, Washington would not be the last person to loan out his copy of Jethro Tull and never get it back. Thomas Jefferson loaned his to Edmund Randolph, who lost the book. It is a testament to the utility of Jethro Tull's horse-hoeing husbandry that borrowers hesitated to return the book. By 1786, Washington could no longer do without a copy of Jethro Tull at Mount Vernon and ordered a new edition, neatly bound and lettered. The almanac was another kind of book on the colonial farmer's bookshelf. Typically published a few months before the start of a new year, almanacs gave farmers essential information to help them decide when to sow and when to reap. Williamsburg booksellers sold Virginia almanacs interleaved with blank pages, which provided users with plenty of white space to record miscellaneous notes throughout the year. Thomas Jefferson bought an interleaved copy of the Virginia Almanac every year and filled the blank pages with notes. So did George Washington. Washington used his interleaved almanacs as diaries. A copy of Joseph Royal's Virginia Almanac for 1762 is his earliest surviving almanac. His manuscript notes in it capture the day-to-day activities at Mount Vernon that year. On February 9th, for example, he recorded, "Began plowing for oats." He did not finish plowing for oats, about 20 acres later, until Saturday, March 20th. The following Saturday, he finished sowing and harrowing his oats, 44 bushels altogether. The last Monday in April, he began planting corn at all his plantations, a task that would take until the first Tuesday in May. Other notes concern current building projects at Mount Vernon. Guy, a local bricklayer from a neighboring plantation, came to Mount Vernon in early May. Washington noted, "Guy began the garden wall after having built an oven in the kitchen, laid the hearth, and repaired the back." Additional details Washington recorded in the 1762 almanac bring alive other aspects of his daily life. That month he recorded receiving a cask of Leith ale from a tavern keeper in Piscataway, a potent brew. This year he also imported 12 dozen bottles of fine old porter. Though Washington enjoyed imported ale from England and Scotland, eventually he would brew his own at Mount Vernon. Many of the notes in the 1762 almanac concern livestock, several about breeding. In late May, for example, Washington hired a neighbor's stud horse to service his mares. The horse covered both young Countess and the black mare. The next day, the same horse covered the chestnut mare, but young Countess and the black mare both refused. In his new treatise on the diseases of horses, William Gibson demurely avoided discussing how to breed horses. Washington gained his knowledge on that subject locally by word of mouth. An interleaved almanac provided a convenient place to record daily activities throughout the year, but it remained useful once the year ended, when a note-filled almanac transformed itself from an ephemeris into a lasting reference work. Washington saved his almanacs from one year to the next. As he matured as a farmer, he used earlier almanacs to gauge his subsequent progress. Every year he could compare his current efforts and results with those of the previous years. Washington's diary entries in his almanacs, brief as they are, also illuminate his personality, as John Seeley has recognized. While admitting that Washington was not an inspired keeper of a diary, Seeley observes that reading his diaries straight through gives the impression of the progress of an ideal provincial squire who begins with earnest efforts at agrarian improvements and moves toward fox hunting and improving his breed of hound, and in the background, as it were, we can see an ever-widening vista as Mount Vernon gives way to the Ohio Valley and Williamsburg. Not all day-to-day notes needed to be saved. From 1759, Washington began carrying an ivory table book to record miscellaneous notes. fashioned from several oblong strips of ivory attached together at one end so that they could be spread out like a fan, ivory table books had many advantages over interleaved almanacs. They were convenient, durable, reusable, and waterproof. The table book provided a way to take notes on the fly. Furthermore, its leaves could be inscribed, wiped clean, and re-inscribed. As Jonathan Swift wrote in his playful poem, Written in a Lady's Ivory Table Book, all it took to blot a message out was the power of spittle and a clout. Washington could inscribe daily notes in his ivory table book, transfer the most important ones to an interleaved almanac, and then erase the table book to use it again. Throughout his first year of marriage, Washington continued to obtain decorative objects for Mount Vernon. The third week of September, 1759, he wrote Robert Carey requesting some statuary for his home, including six busts. Washington's choice of historical figures says much about the men he admired. In addition to busts of Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, he ordered those of King Charles XII of Sweden and Frederick II, King of Prussia. He wanted all four the same size, less than 15 inches tall, because he planned to use them to fill the broken pediments over the doors at Mount Vernon. Washington also ordered busts of the Duke of Marlborough and Prince Eugene of Savoy for either end of another pediment. Grouping Marlborough and Prince Eugene, Washington revealed his knowledge of their exploits. The two commanders were close friends who served together during the War of the Spanish Succession. Prince Eugene helped Marlborough achieve his glorious victory at Blenheim. While the agricultural books show Washington settling into the life of a gentleman farmer, the busts he wanted reveal a contrary impulse. They show him longing for the battlefield. All these famous leaders were best known for their military exploits. Contemporaries held them up as models to emulate. To prove that the Virginia Regiment could trounce the more powerful French forces, the Reverend Samuel Davies used both Alexander the Great and King Charles XII of Sweden as examples. In the first number of his Virginia Sentinel essay series, Davies wrote that Alexander the Great, commanding a force of 30,000 troops, routed Darius, who had an army of 500,000. Furthermore, Davies continued, Charles XII of Sweden, with 8,000 Swedish troops, overwhelmingly defeated 100,000 Russian soldiers. Washington's admiration of these prominent military figures reflects his reading. Like many 18th-century Virginians, he enjoyed biographies of great men. Grub Street biographer John Banks wrote several works that became popular in colonial America. Years later, Washington would order John Banks's History of the Life and Reign of the Tsar Peter the Great, but he could have read Banks's biographies of Prince Eugene of Savoy and the Duke of Marlborough by the time he ordered busts of them in 1759. Frederick II, King of Prussia, the latest figure on the list of famous soldiers Washington wanted to honor at Mount Vernon, was recognized as a great hero because of his victory over the French, with whom Great Britain and its colonies were still fighting. Numerous verse tributes to Frederick had appeared in the American press. In The Royal Comet, James Stirling, another man of letters in colonial Maryland, honored Frederick the Great as the first in the charge and the last in retreat, a statesman and monarch, yet true to his word, a soldier with honor more bright than his sword. According to the popular perception of him in North America, Frederick the Great possessed many of the same qualities Washington admired and sought to cultivate himself. Carey had trouble locating busts of any of these men. He could find none of Charles XII of Sweden, nor could he find busts of the others in the size Washington needed. Carey offered some alternatives, explaining that he could easily obtain busts of Addison, Aristotle, Chaucer, Cicero, Homer, Horace, Johnson, Locke, Milton, Newton, Plato, Pope, Seneca, Spencer, Swift, Dryden, and Virgil. Poets and philosophers? No, Washington replied. He was uninterested in the busts of any of these figures. To adorn his home, he wanted men of action, not men of letters. Washington later reconsidered. When the Belvoir estate went up for sale, he purchased William Fairfax's bust of Shakespeare for Mount Vernon. Washington also ordered statues of two wild animals. He was less choosy about the beasts than the busts. Furious wild beasts of any kind would do. He imagined these animals approaching each other and eager to engage. Given the opportunity to decide which beasts would go best, Carey chose two statues patterned on some antique Italian lions, neatly finished and bronzed. In addition, Washington ordered some smaller ornaments for the mantelpiece, again leaving the details to his London agent. Carey outdid himself this time. He selected a group of four prominent figures, Aeneas bearing his father Anchises from the flames of Troy upon his shoulder, accompanied by Aeneas's wife Creusa and their son Ascanius, all neatly finished and bronzed. The group of figures captures a precise moment in classical legend. After the Greeks took Troy and set it aflame, they permitted Aeneas to remove what he most esteemed. Consequently, Aeneas carried his crippled father, Anchises, through the flames and thus saved his life. Aeneas also rescued his son from the fire and brought him to Italy. Creusa accompanied them, but according to the traditional story, she was accidentally separated from Aeneas. Placed at Mount Vernon, this group of statues gave the Washington home a rich set of classical associations. Presenting a story about rescue from fire, the Aeneas group served as a good luck charm, symbolically protecting Mount Vernon from conflagration, an ever-present danger for 18th-century homeowners. It also reinforced the importance of family, symbolizing the love between father and son, husband and wife. Furthermore, the image of Aeneas carrying Anchises indicates the importance of filial piety. Leaving the ruins of Troy behind him, Aeneas also symbolizes translatio, the idea that, as George Barclay famously put it, westward the course of empire makes its way. Aeneas leaving Troy is one manifestation of this idea. The settling of America is another. Carey sent two bronze vases ornamented with faces and festoons of grapes and vines, and two more groups of statuary to rest on the mantle. One group featured Bacchus, the god of wine. A symbol of merrymaking, Bacchus helped assure a joyful home. The other group featured Flora, the Roman goddess of flowers and gardens, thus guaranteeing beauty and prosperity. Washington needed more than symbols to assure Mount Vernon's prosperity. He continued expanding his agricultural library over the next few years. The Practical Husbandman, which he would add by 1764, consisted of papers selected from the Transactions of the Society of Improvers in the Knowledge of Agriculture in Scotland by its secretary, a successful Scottish farmer named Robert Maxwell. The Farmer's Complete Guide, an anonymous work Washington added to his library around the same time, contains information about managing stock, growing grain, cultivating beans and peas and turnips, raising hemp and hops, and manuring soil. The knowing farmer, Washington later observed, was one who understands the best course of crops, how to plow, to sow, to mow, to hedge, to ditch, and above all, my dislike, one who can convert everything he touches into manure as the first transmutation towards gold. The two most important agricultural works Washington acquired in the 1760s were Philip Miller's Gardener's Dictionary and Duhamel du Monceau's Practical Treatise of Husbandry. Miller could be found in libraries throughout colonial America. Duhamel was rarer. Only the best agricultural libraries, like that of Charles Carroll, barrister, had both. On his travels through North America, Swedish naturalist Per Kalm asked people what they considered the best book on the subject of horticulture. They generally agreed that Miller's Gardener's Dictionary was the best of all, and that when one has it, no other book is afterwards required, because there is found in it everything that is in the others, and much more besides, and that both more clearly and better worked out than in any other, although the others often have manifold more words. Washington owned Miller's abridgment of the Gardener's Dictionary. Though less detailed than Miller's original, the abridgment was still a hefty quarto, consisting of over 900 closely printed pages. Many farmers appreciated Miller's information about trees. So did Washington. Instead of limiting himself to English varieties, Miller sought to incorporate much about American species. As an unpublished manuscript at Mount Vernon reveals, Washington compiled lengthy notes on many different species of trees: dogwood, horse chestnut, laurel, locust, magnolia, redbud, sassafras. He kept his copy of Miller's Gardener's Dictionary nearby as he wrote, supplementing his notes with additional information from the book. After reading Miller's article on various types of magnolias, Washington wrote a kinsman traveling to South Carolina asking him to obtain some magnolia seed. Washington also mentioned Miller to another correspondent, whom he asked to send seed for some pine trees and other evergreens. Washington kept reading Miller's Gardener's Dictionary, which continued to impress him. In a follow-up letter, he observed that Miller seems to understand the culture of trees equal to any other writer I have met with. A dated autograph on Washington's copy of Duhamel's Practical Treatise of Husbandry enhances its rubricated title page: G. Washington, 1764. The volume also contains brief marginal annotations in Washington's hand on dozens of pages. Duhamel divided his text into four parts. Washington's marginalia are largely restricted to the second part of the book. Since the first part contains no marginalia, one might conclude that Washington skipped that part altogether and went directly to part two. Washington's marginalia are not the only evidence to indicate his attention to the work. A set of notes in his hand at the Library of Congress shows that he thoroughly digested part one. As he read Duhamel, he copied long passages of text into a separate notebook. These manuscript notes caution against making too many generalizations about Washington's reading process based solely on his marginalia. He took notes in different ways at different times for different reasons, even from the same work. The nature of the individual parts of Duhamel's treatise help explain Washington's notes. Part one consists of general information about several aspects of husbandry. Part two presents the results of numerous agricultural experiments. Washington took notes from part one to help him learn and remember Duhamel's ideas. His manuscript notes in part two mainly serve to make the book a more useful reference work. Much of his marginalia converts the original measurements to proper English ones. Washington's notes make Duhamel's text easier to reread and Duhamel's experiments easier to replicate. That the notes largely concern the cultivation of wheat reinforces Washington's ongoing shift from tobacco. Some of his notes in Duhamel's husbandry resemble ones he made in his copy of Harris's Lexicon Technicum. They concern units of measurement and ways of measuring different agricultural products. Washington also wrote in parts 3 and 4 of Duhamel's husbandry, but his later annotations mainly correct typographical errors. Correcting some mistaken Roman numerals, for example, he deliberately made his handwriting resemble Roman type. Brief as they are, these corrections demonstrate that he thoroughly read parts 3 and 4 as well. Washington's notes reveal his interest in the possible benefits of the use of tillage, as opposed to the sole use of dung. In addition, Duhamel's defense of the Rotherham, or patent, plow convinced Washington to acquire one for himself. When his patent plow finally broke down, Washington returned to Duhamel for further inspiration, but ultimately designed a plow of his own. His agricultural activity at Mount Vernon shows that he learned much else from Duhamel's husbandry. Soil preparation, crop rotation, and the value of detailed record-keeping from year to year. Duhamel recommended all these aspects of farming, and Washington followed him. His agricultural innovations made him a leader among Virginia farmers. He continued to expand his agricultural library throughout his life. One more example must suffice. John Abercrombie's Hothouse Gardener. "He who loves a garden loves a greenhouse too," William Cowper observed. Washington was no exception. Sure enough, he would install a stately greenhouse at Mount Vernon. The structure was partly inspired by the one Charles Carroll installed at Mount Clare. His wife, Margaret, took primary responsibility for the Carroll greenhouse. She prided herself on her oranges and lemons, and the Mount Clare greenhouse developed a reputation beyond the bounds of Maryland. As Washington designed his, he realized that he lacked sufficient knowledge for the task, nor could he find anyone in Virginia who could help. Consequently, he wrote Tench Tillman, Margaret Carroll's cousin, asking him to describe the Mount Clare greenhouse in detail. When Tillman consulted her, she was happy to answer Washington's numerous queries herself. It took him a couple of years to finish constructing his Mount Vernon greenhouse, and a few years after that before Washington found a gardener with greenhouse expertise. He subsequently wrote directly to Margaret Carroll, accepting her offer to supply him with specimens from her greenhouse. She sent 20 pots of lemon and orange trees and 5 boxes of other greenhouse plants to Mount Vernon. Washington's greenhouse is a beautiful sight, inside and out. Impressed with it, during his visit to Mount Vernon, the Chevalier de Rougeau offered to present him a book on the subject. Washington graciously accepted. The book turned out to be Abercrombie's Hothouse Gardener, which came with engraved and hand-colored illustrations. The story of Washington's greenhouse shows him gathering information in several different ways. Initially, he tried to learn about greenhouses personally. He asked friends and neighbors what they knew. When he could not find sufficient local expertise, he broadened his horizons and looked to Maryland for help, writing Tench Tillman first, and later directly corresponding with Margaret Carroll. Eventually, he did meet a gardener with greenhouse experience, but even with what he learned about greenhouses personally and through his correspondence, Washington welcomed a book on the subject. Personal contact, correspondence, and the printed word all gave Washington complimentary ways of learning about gardens, about greenhouses, about anything.